Today is Wednesday, October 25th, 2023. This is part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Peter Huntoon. Peter spells his last name H-U-N-T-O-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Very good.
This interview today is being conducted in the dining room of Tom Martin's house in Flagstaff, Arizona. And so I will not ask you if we can record this oral history over the telephone because we are face to face. Peter, I wanted to ask you, at the end of part 10, you mentioned an exchange program that you got into. Can you pick that thread up?
Yeah, we can talk about that. What I got involved in was a meeting in China in a place called Guilin in South China. It was held about 1985, where this was an international meeting put together by the Chinese and car scientists, people that are interested in limestone and caves and all that, converged on the place. And there were several hundred foreign participants here. It was one of the biggest conferences I've been to. Wow. And this was hosted by the Chinese as they were trying to open up. Anyway, once we arrived, we had a few days of meetings and field trips all over the area. And at the end of the thing, a Chinese car scientist put up a notice that he would like to meet anybody that might be interested in some kind of exchange programs. This guy's name was Ru Jinwen. And I saw that and I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. It was going to be held like at 7:30 in the evening or something like that. So I showed up, and it turned out of all those people that were at the conference, only two people came.
Just two.
And I was, of course, one of them. And we started talking a little bit. And he was just generally talking about the Carson, South China. And I saw this as a great opportunity for a sabbatical. I was kind of due for one. And so I pursued it. I don't know whatever happened to the other guy. I don't think he did anything.
Peter, when I think about the karst in South China, of which I know absolutely nothing, I think about the Redwall limestone, the karst limestones in America. That can't be the same rock unit, same age, is it?
Well, it's basically the same age. Usually it is. It's the...
Wow.
Anything from the Cambrian through the Paleozoic is going to have a lot of limestone in it.
Okay.
But the thing that makes the South China area so interesting is that virtually all of it is covered by limestone, and it's in a subtropical climatic zone, and it has been for a long time. And this stuff is very deeply eroded. So if you can imagine the Colorado Plateau being very deeply eroded, and all that's left are thousands of towers, then you have the South China Karst.
Wow.
And the towers are made up of limestone, of course, and the intervening areas have been eroded away. But the towers themselves are just loaded with caves. And so this is a very exotic landscape, and it's very common in Southeast Asia. The other feature about it is it's a subtropical area, so it had a dense forest that covered the entire thing. We're talking about really dense, I mean, jungle-like. And so that was the setting. It's and it covers a huge area. It covers the whole, maybe about the lower fifth of all of China. This is big. So we're talking about areas about the size of Montana or bigger.
That
kind of thing.
Wow.
So anyway, that was where the thing was held. And Guilin is a major tourist area for people. And they come to look at this thing, and there's a thing called the Lee River, and you take river trips down through this and look at all this beautiful scenery and all that kind of stuff. So that was the setting. Anyway, I saw this, and I saw this look like an interesting thing. So I started talking to this fellow about doing a sabbatical, and within a year or so, I was over there for like 3 months, and spent the time there looking at this. Once we got there, once I got there, they had arranged for me to look at a lot of things, and you know, it was sort of a big dog and pony show. But the thing that really struck me was, is that there were no trees. Here we are in a subtropical rainforest environment, and there were no trees. And as a matter of fact, as we were driving around, once in a while, you would see a tree. And it was so exotic next to the karst, I'd take a photograph of it.
Wow.
Well, after a little while, it didn't take a long time to figure this out, I learned that this place had been totally deforested. And what had happened was, at the end of the 1950s, Chairman Mao, who was from this area, he was from South China, he was trying to build an infrastructure in China, primarily around railroads, to rival what the English had done. And so he needed concrete and steel in vast quantities. And he was looking for a source for this material. And he thought about his homeland. And he waved his hand over the map. And he just said to his minions, cut those lousy trees down, turn them into charcoal, and let's smelt iron ore with that charcoal. So what they did is, for a couple of years, they sent all the peasants out into the forest, and they cut down all the trees. And we're talking about all the trees over an area probably bigger than Montana. They cut them all. And they turned them into charcoal. And then they mined low-grade iron ore and tried to use this charcoal to smelt the ore and all that kind of thing. The pressure on these people was enormous to produce this kind of stuff. And there were a number of things that happened. First, if you think about it, they cut down all the trees. So what they did is they destroyed the ecology they were living in. And this was a disaster, because what they ended up doing was drying out all the soils. So they were wrecking their ability to plant crops between the trees. And the other thing that happened was, once they dried out the soils, then the trees were gone, the temperatures went up. And so the area got a lot hotter than it used to be, which baked the soils, which were mostly red clays, into almost adobe bricks. So that killed their agricultural industry down there. That was a real disaster. Of course, they lost buku native animals and birds, of course. They were gone. You hardly ever saw a bird down there and all that kind of thing. It was an absolute disaster. Okay, now what you did is you put a huge population at risk. And this area supported about 100 million people. And they were now on the edge. Okay. They started to experience famines. The pressure was on to continue getting these resources out. If you can believe it or not, the pressure got so great, they sent all these people back out into the deforested area and had them dig up every stump and bring them in and turn the stumps into charcoal. They couldn't produce the iron that they were supposed to, their quotas. So what they started doing was throwing their tools in and melting them down. So what they were doing was destroying their livelihoods. After a couple of years, the death toll by starvation was supposed to run somewhere around 20 million people. This was really a fantastic story. And I was running around the place taking pictures of all this stuff. And when I was done after 3 months, I came back with a phenomenal photo record of this thing and the story. And I had a lot of personal accounts of the disaster from older people that wanted the story told. The story was never told. So I wrote a couple of journal articles about it and thought, well, this is kind of an interesting historic thing because I'm writing this in the 95 or something like that. But it turns out that this was a big news item because a lot of the West
didn't know.
And the result was I kept getting requests to come to other meetings, particularly foreign meetings, and give these papers, and they'd publish it.
Wow.
So of the academic work I did, this was probably the most reproduced work of all my career, and it appeared in journals all over the world, including even Cuba, for example.
Wow.
You know, it's really quite the deal. But mostly it was in the Middle East and Europe that this stuff got published. So this was a really interesting experience. And it's one of those things that is a persistent problem to this day because they haven't been able to substantially revegetate this area. They've had large programs to try to plant trees and get things going. But of course, the soil was ruined. So they had a terrible time doing this. And they just haven't had luck with it. Now, when I was down there, it was very interesting. A lot of this terrain was starting to grow up in almost impenetrable brush and, you know, ragged weeds. And at least you would think that that's a start. But the place is still highly populated. And so what happens is every day that I was there during the growing season, you would see armies of women come out of the towns, go into the hills and cut all this brush down and haul it out. And they would come back in the late afternoon with their bundles of brush. And that was their fuel for cooking. And what they would do is they'd mow over this whole place every single year.
So this sounds like maybe an exotic species that moved in that now they're cutting down and it just grows right back.
Yeah, it's junk stuff. What we would consider weeds, and little brush. And they just cut it all down every year. Wow. I would, some of the most amazing things you'd see, we'd be driving along. And you'd see where they were baking bricks. They make adobe bricks there. The fuel they're using is nothing more than straw.
Oh, wow.
And they think they're doing really good if they got a branch that's an inch in diameter they can feed into the fire. You can imagine how much of this it takes to bake a load of bricks.
Yeah.
So they got to send these people out to cut this stuff down. And it's just a disaster. It's one of the biggest ecological disasters I've seen outside areas that are eaten by goats, which is the Middle East problem. But anyway, this was quite the experience seeing that. I went back there. I had one 3-month sabbatical that I spent there. And then I returned on another sabbatical for a couple of months and got the rest of the story and got out of there. So I was over there for a total of about 5 or 6 months observing this. Of course, we were doing other kinds of work at the same time, and that's one of the things that was fun for me, of course, is that this is in the middle of their karst area, which is loaded with caves, and they have large caves. And it's one of the few places where we could go exploring, my wife and I, you could wear a backpack. These caves were so large, you just walked through them. They were enormous, and they were hardly touched.
Wow.
There were a couple of really exotic experiences we had. We went to a village. It was in the boondocks. It was called Shopingyan. And right outside of town was this big mass of limestone, and there was a stream cave that went through it. And we were able to find access to the stream cave. One day, a couple of peasants showed us an entrance to it, and it turned out it had multiple entrances, but we got into the thing. And we were walking down a passage that had a very small stream that went through it. And we got in there maybe a half a mile or something like that. And we came on a lake. This lake was, I don't know, maybe a couple hundred feet in diameter. And had a very low ceiling. The ceiling was only a couple of feet above the water. But anyway, here we are standing on the upstream side of this lake, but I could hear running water. That was an experience I've never had in a cave before. You know, obviously what was going on was the lake was overflowing and I could hear the rapids below it.
Wow.
So I was real excited about this because obviously the cave continued and I just never experienced a lake in a cave like that before. So we got out of the cave and I talked to our minders, the people that were accompanying us, and I arranged for them to come up with a couple of inner tubes. And what my wife and I did was we came in there the next day or two and we blew up the inner tubes and swam across the lake. And sure enough, we got to the other side and the water was spilling down a passageway and it just went as far as we wanted to walk. It was amazing. Now, as we were in this cave, this was not exactly by the rules caving. We were caving with Chinese flashlights, not good lamps of any quality, and they were notoriously bad. We each started in the cave with three flashlights each, knowing that they were going to burn out on us. And that particular trip, we were probably in the cave for maybe 3 or 4 hours. And when we arrived at the entrance, we had one working light left. It was a little too thin. But anyway, that was kind of
wow. Bad.
What we would do, we'd be walking through the passageways, and it would open up into a room that would be maybe 75 or 80 feet high, you know, and you couldn't see the sides. And we would be looking at beautiful stalagmites and stalagmites that went from floor to ceiling, absolutely untouched. Nobody had been writing on them or anything like that. It was wonderful. One day we were in there. We were coming out one of the passageways that went to the land surface, and we noticed an opening off on the right as we were coming out. It looked like it went into a room. And so we ducked in just to see what we had. And this was sort of this slot on the side of the passageway. You walked up to it. It was low. You had to stoop to get in it. And as soon as you got in it, it opened up into a big room. And the first thing we saw was magnificent white crystal formations on our whole scene, which was, you know, spreading in front of us by, you know, maybe 50 or 100 yards. Big room. And so, of course, we went in there just to see the pretty formations, obviously. And as we were walking in, we noticed that we were on a mud floor, and which is nothing unusual, except there was one set of footprints going in and another set coming out. And whoever did it was barefooted and had very small feet. We were looking at something that was prehistoric.
Wow.
And boy, that was a real experience. Nobody had been in there since this guy had been in there eons ago. And of course, we were horrified. We didn't want to be leaving footprints on top of that. So we skedaddled out of there and left the place alone. But it wasn't until, you know, we walked over a few of these things that we noticed that. I always wondered who that guy was.
And that person's flashlight, in quotes, would have been some sort of torch?
Yeah, it would have been some prehistoric. You know, this would have been old.
Wow.
Yeah, you don't know where.
Hopefully they had two torches, or maybe three. You burn one out, you got the next couple going. Wow. Wow. What did you learn from the karst caves there?
Well, like I said, the big story I got out of there was this deforestation story.
Right.
That is the big deal. Right. And what they were interested in, what my hosts were interested in, was trying to develop water supplies in this area because it had been so... When you cut a forest, you lose what the Chinese call the green reservoir. And what they're talking about, and this is a real lesson for everybody, when you cut a forest, you dry the land. And the plants hold a tremendous amount of water in the root structure, and they hold it in the soil. And when you cut it, all that goes away, and you got bare rock, and then nothing stays. So these people had, they deforested, and they had also dried this area out. It absolutely went through a climate change. And the result was that they had inadequate water supplies for the huge population that still was there. So they were interested in anything, any technology that would give them water. And of course, the only place they could look was down at their feet, and they were trying to drill or dig holes and stuff like that. So I got to see the technologies they were using to try to get at their water. And with the people and the lack of any kind of economics, mostly what they were doing was digging holes. And you might go to a place where there'd be maybe 20 or 30 people digging a hole down into the soils that they could find to see if they could get down to the water. I got phenomenal pictures of this stuff, of these people doing this kind of work just to scrape by where they could come in. Now, the other thing about South China was that the primary use they have for their women, girls and adult women, is to haul water. That's all you see. They're all carrying buckets, and they might have to walk 3 to 5 kilometers to one of these holes with water in it and carry a bucket back to the house because that's what they had. Whereas before they deforested, they would have little springs and seeps that were coming out right next to the house.
Wow.
And they could collect it right there. So, I mean, this was a very painful thing to see. And when you ran into these women that had been carrying water for their whole lives, they were broken down wrecks.
Yeah.
It was really something.
Yeah.
We had wonderful experiences hitting on this theme. My wife and I were the first Westerners that got into some of these areas since the Second World War. So we were exotic. And there's a couple of anecdotes that are fun to tell about this. One day we were with a bunch of Chinese officials who were serving as my host. They had been contacted, told we were coming, and they all wanted to come out and meet you and all that, this kind of stuff. So we were driving into this village with this bunch of guys in a van. And I was sitting in the back with my arm hanging out the window. Well, we drove into this village, and there was a school on the right. And there were a couple of kids out playing, and they saw these two Westerners in the car. And they ran into school, and they yelled out something, and the whole place emptied out. And all these students came running out. All these grammar students came running out. And they ran around the car to look at these Westerners. And they were all pointing at our blue eyes and blonde hair and all this kind of stuff. It was really quite amusing. And my arm was hanging out the window, and these little rascals would come running up and pull the blonde hairs out so they could have a souvenir.
Wow.
Yeah, that was funny. Another time we were coming out of a hilly area, and we were walking down this ox cart track, and there was a young guy. He was probably maybe he was in his early 20s, something like that, and he was riding a cart out that was drawn by a ox, and he was in front of us, and we were going the same direction. It was just my wife and I. Our minders were waiting for us down at a junction, And so they were a couple of kilometers away. So we were out there by ourselves. And this guy noticed this. And then all of a sudden, as we started getting close to his cart, he's whipping the ox to get it to go. And the thing starts moving out at a slow pace. And we were gaining on it. And the closer we got, the worse the whipping got. And pretty soon, you know, like 2 or 3 minutes later, the guy jumps off the cart and he gets in front of the ox and he's pulling him. And of course, we're still gaining on him. And as we get about 25 feet away from the guy, he throws up the leash that he's pulling the ox with and just goes tearing off down the road and disappears into the countryside. And I'm looking at this and I finally got the idea. What he had seen were two white devils, and we just scared him to death.
Wow.
You know, this kind of cultural thing is amazing. On another occasion, we were doing the same thing. We were coming out one of these ox cart roads, and we hit a junction. And at the junction were two women who had a pop stand where they were selling Cokes and things like this, you know. And one was an old woman, and the other was her daughter. Well, the old woman knew Westerners from World War II. So we showed up, and we sat down and ordered a we were buying a can of pop each. And the two women are back there huddled, you know, talking about us, obviously. And what really tickled me was the older woman comes out, and she comes right up behind me, and she starts running her fingers through my hair from the back, you know, almost in a sensuous way. And what she's doing is explaining to the her daughter about these people have blonde hair, and they're really okay, you know, and wow, all this kind of stuff. And the daughter's real standoffish, and she's kind of half snickering and half embarrassed and the whole nine yards. It was a great experience.
Lovely.
It was really, really funny, you know.
Cool.
But you had these experiences. Another thing that was very impressive in this area, when we ran into a junction where a main road would be have a spur going off to a little town, what you would very commonly see was there was an outhouse or a place to go, not an outhouse, but a place to go on all four corners. And you want to, you know, what's the deal here? Well, the deal is that the Chinese use night soil as fertilizer.
Hmm.
So what you are looking at is four competitors for your droppings.
Got it.
Yeah, this kind of stuff is phenomenal. Huh. Let's start seeing it and figure it out.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, wow. Anyway, it was a real real interesting period of time. Now, my my wife is, she's kind of a risk taker, and she likes to learn languages.
What's your wife's name?
Kathleen.
This is Kathleen.
Kathleen.
Okay.
Kathleen.
Where did you meet her?
She was a friend of mine in Española, New Mexico. I just happened to run into her one time.
Okay.
So anyway, what happened
and,
was...
And she clearly liked to cave.
Well, no, she never did any of this in her life. She's just going along for the ride, but okay, she was a real sport about it.
Okay.
And which I was very lucky.
And she didn't mind going to rural China. And
no, she was really into China, and she wanted to learn Chinese.
Oh, wow.
And she's good with languages, so
okay,
this made sense. So what she ended up doing was she enrolled in the Beijing Language Institute, which teaches Chinese to foreigners.
Huh.
And she went over there during the winter after one of these sabbaticals. And she stayed there through the winter at this language institute. And then what I did is flew over to meet her at the end of this, and our plan was to go out into Western China and see the clay statues at the, where is it, Xi'an or wherever that place is, and maybe go beyond that.
Hmm.
That was our plan. So she stayed there all winter and endured this. And this was a really a difficult experience because they don't have space heating in that part of China, in Beijing. So if you want to live there in the winter, you're bundled up in your woolies all winter long and things like that. One of the things I found amusing was surrounding the institute were all these vendors that were selling soups, you know, noodle soup, any kind of soup. And they had chits. And these chits cost about 5 to 25 cents. And you could have two or three of these chits and you could stuff yourself. You know, it was really good. And it was really great stuff. But anyway, by the time I got there, Kathleen was really burned out. I mean, yeah, you can imagine. She spent several months there and she was looking for a ticket out and some comfort. And after I realized that my big plans for traveling and Western China were going up the flue, I just said, okay, look, you got to get out of here. So put her on a plane and she flew back home from Beijing. And I stayed there in Beijing. And I thought, well, I better finish this off. So I tried to make arrangements to take the train out to where these clay statues were, which is halfway across China. And there were so many tourists going out there, I couldn't get tickets. So I finally said, the heck with that. I decided to fly out to a place called near Urumqi, way out in western China, just north of the Karakoram Range, which is near the Himalayas. And I thought, okay, I'll fly out there. There's a road that goes down to Pakistan. It's about a half an inch on my globe. I'll take that road and see what happens. And so I flew out to Xi'an, out to Urumqi, and got off there. And that was an interesting flight because the plane we took was it was about the size of a big passenger jet, but it was an old Russian plane that felt like it was made out of cast iron. That thing was the heaviest plane. You could just tell. And it had the most gigantic engines to run it. And that was quite the flight. But anyway, got off at this town and I started scouting around and I learned that there was buses going south towards Pakistan, towards southern China. And so I got off on those and they were going to a place called the Turin Basin, which is a low area. It's a little below sea level, right next to the Karakoram Range, which rises up to something like 18,000 feet or something like that. Huh. And so this sounded like an interesting place to go. So I arranged to take one of these buses. And it was a three-day trip down there. And that was a great experience. The buses go day and night. They make two stops for food and whatever you can grab from vendors, and they don't have seats. What they have is rows of cots, three rows of cots going down through the bus, and you rent a cot. And what I did is I simply grabbed a cot at the front so I could look out the front window and see where we were going and like that, you know. And
I'm just curious, did your wife, Kathleen, knows Chinese? She's left. Do you have a minder with you? Do you have any translators with you? Or are you trying to work this out on your own?
No, I'm doing it all. It's all on a come.
And you don't have this fancy smarty pants phone with Google Translate in there.
All I got is a couple of hundred yuan in my clothes and, you know.
Wow.
I had a little backpack, you know.
Okay.
Obviously, this is all new. The idea was this. The idea was, let's try to get out to the end of the earth and see if you can get back on your own.
Wow.
That's what it was all about. So what I did on this trip was, obviously, I had to worry about food and also water. And I was there during the growing season, so what I did was I bought three watermelons, And I simply ate those and used them for my water supply. Also, I had bought a bottle of water. I had a couple of bottles of water, but I didn't need it with these watermelons. Now, this Nice. Was a very interesting trip because most of the passengers on this bus that I was on were Pakistani traders and Western Muslims that lived in China who are a minority there.
Is that the Uyghurs?
The Uyghurs. And they're very badly persecuted. And they were the primary people. And it was very interesting to be with these people. And I was the only Anglo on this particular bus. And so I started to get to know them a little bit. And there was one Uyghur couple that was sitting next to me. They were a young couple. And of course, they were very conservative Muslims. And the woman was all covered up with a burqa and their, and everything. And I watched them, and they just weren't eating, you know, 2-3 days. And finally, I cut them a slice of watermelon. And boy, I'll tell you, they lit up, and they ate that thing. And that's the first time I saw her teeth, you know. Because she finally had to take her covering off her mouth. You know, that was a very interesting little trip.
Wow.
Well, I got down there. I can't remember the name of the town, but I got down towards the Chinese border. And I had two choices. I could go down into the Turin Basin, which goes a little below sea level, and see what that's about. Or I could catch a bus over to Islamabad, Pakistan. And I thought, well, while I'm here, I'm going to do both. So I went down to Turin Basin, and I was dropped down in there, took a bus in there. And this was a place that had hydrologic features that were of great interest to me. What they're called is kanats. That's Q-A-N-A-T. And kanats are very interesting. They're tunnels that they dig into the alluvial fans that come off these steep ranges. And the tunnel is sloped slightly upward as they dig into the alluvial fan, and they dig it until they hit the water table that's under the alluvial fan.
Oh, wow.
And they line the passageway with clay so that the water runs out through their tunnel instead of going down through the groundwater system to the bottom of the valley.
Hmm.
And then they can irrigate with it. And this is a technology that is pervasive in Southeast Asia, and it also goes all the way over the Middle East. And I knew it from the Middle East, but I didn't have any idea it was in China. And
wow.
this was amazing. But what you would do is you drive for miles across these valleys with big alluvial fans coming out of the mountains, and it looked like there was anthills all over the place. And what they were tunnels, vertical shafts, where they got rid of the diggings as they dug these canets. And they just snaked up into the hills. You'd just see a line of them, and that was a canet.
Wow.
And then you'd see fields underneath that they were growing stuff in.
So they would dig for a while into this alluvial material. Then they would do a shaft up to daylight.
And yeah, just to get rid of the material.
Well, it would also give them air for the miners that were digging.
Right.
Then they would dig more and do another. So you were seeing these shafts that were going down to the tunnel, or the drift, I guess it would be, off to get to the water table.
Right.
Wow.
Really neat technology. And it's old as the hills.
Wow. Yeah. What were they? I wonder what their digging tools were.
Well, they were just crude, you know, because it's small rocks and soil, so it's pickaxe. You know, it's all land labor.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's old.
Wow.
Because, of course, now they've come in with wells, and this stuff has all been left behind, or it's getting left behind.
Right.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Huh. I got down to the bottom of the valley, and the next day I took a hike up onto a little peak that was there. You know, we're talking about something that's stuck up of maybe 1,000 feet above the bottom. It was like taking a hike up one of the hills in Death Valley. But it was kind of interesting. But I was alone. So I decided to go back to the starting point where I'd gotten off the bus from Urumqi. And there were buses going down the Indus River that they go over the Corcoran Range and down the Indus River to Islamabad. And the way these things operate is the guy would just be parked along the side of the road, and when they finally filled up the bus, okay, you went. So I got on in the late afternoon, and finally we got the bus filled about 7 or 8 at night, and then they took off. Well, that was too bad because most of it was going to be in the dark.
Yeah.
But anyway, we were just at about sea level where we started, and we're going to climb over the Corcoran Range and then drop into Pakistan, and which had two aspects to it. First, you got to grind over the range, and the other thing is you got to go through customs.
Ah.
And that was going to be kind of a new thing for me. Now, at this point, I was the only Anglo around, and so I had to get prepared for this trip. So I had two very interesting experiences. First, I had to go through customs. And then you have to go through immigration. Well, I went to the customs desk, and there was a young woman behind the desk who was clearly she was from Eastern China and was planted out there. And she was educated, very, very nice. And she looked at me, and she hadn't seen anybody like me in a long time. But behind her were these hoops of bread. Little circles of bread. And I'm looking at them because I haven't eaten for a day and a half. And I'm just looking at these things. And she gets the idea. And she just reaches behind and hands me one of them. It's a gift. You know, really nice. And, of course, the paperwork was no problem with her. And I was on my way. But I thought, what a nice act of kindness.
Yeah, yeah.
Then what I had to do is I had to go to the restroom. And the restrooms in China are typical like this. You go in a men's room, and what you have is about a 6 or 8 inch wide ditch that goes down across the floor, and you just all line up on the ditch, and you go in the ditch. And there's a little water flowing through there. And so I'm hunched over the ditch doing my thing, and all of a sudden, and I'm, of course, the last guy in, so I'm at the end of the line downstream, which is the worst end, obviously. And all of a sudden, I hear this pop, flop, and I know what it is. I look down, and there goes a Ziploc bag with my passport and all my money floating away. And now you gotta reach in and get it. So I reached in and got it, of course, pull it out, and of course the Ziploc hadn't ziplocked, so it's getting a little wet in there, and so now what I've got to do is go over to the window. Luckily there was a window in this place, and I had my passport and all my money spread out on the window, drying this stuff off. I have the most beautiful looking passport with all these rainbow colors running through the pages from this experience.
Peter, what year was this again that you're traveling down Islamabad? Was this 1995?
No, this is much later. This is probably in the 90s or something like that.
1998?
Yeah, pretty late. Yeah, that was
okay.
Pretty funny trip. Well, what we did, we got on this bus that went over the Corcoran Range. And it was the classic thing you see in the National Geographic. You got this little box bus that looks like an old bus from downtown. And the load on top of it is as big as the bus. And what it is all these Pakistanis.
The traders.
Yeah, the traders. So they've got all the Chinese goods packed on top of this thing. Hmm. And now you got to go through customs. And the Chinese are working these guys over, and they all have to give them bribes to get this stuff passed. I mean, it takes forever to get through this stuff. And finally, the gate opens, and you go, and you start going. And, of course, this bus is going to go from sea level up to 18,000 feet, and it's going to do it at about 15 miles an hour, and it sounds like it's dying the whole way, and it's going to take a couple of days. And we got up to the summit, finally, and dropped into Pakistan. And all along the way, you're going through checkpoints. They're looking for terrorists. And, of course, we're in Muslim country, so the Chinese are real paranoid about this. And then you drop into Pakistan, and they're looking for terrorists, too. And this is hairy, because every time you go through one of these things, a couple of guys get on the bus with AK-47s, and they're pointed right at your head, and they're going through looking at your papers. Hmm. And they use the muzzles of their gun to leaf through the pages on your passport, that kind of crap, you know. So, and this goes on night and day. And finally, we hit one of these checkpoints in Pakistan, and I thought, I wonder when the last Anglo went through here. And I thought, every time we got to one of these things, they pull all of us foreigners off, and we had to sign in, and they had big ledgers, and you would sign in and put your passport number and where you're from and that. And so I realized that there was a record. So I grabbed one of these ledgers when I was at one of these passport places, or at one of these check stations, and I leafed back until I finally found an American.
Wow.
And the last guy that had been through there had come up from Pakistan, and he was from the Colorado. He was at the college in Fort Collins, an ag guy, who'd come up from Pakistan and turned around and gone back, and he'd gone through the checkpoint. So he was the last guy. He was 3 months in. Well, it turned out there was a reason for this, and that was they were having unrest in this area, and they were having battles with the minorities in Pakistan. So it was hairy, and, you know, this meant that it was a problem. And here I was walking into this thing. Well, anyway, we finally got down to Islamabad. Before we got to Islamabad, I made friends with a fellow that was riding along, and this guy was particularly interesting. He was an Iranian who had become a citizen in Sweden, and his hobby was following what's that trail that they all used
to Silk Road?
Yeah, the Silk Road. He was a Silk Road freak.
Wow.
And so this guy, he would do a few hundred miles of the Silk Road every time he got a vacation. Wow. And it just happened that we were on part of the Silk Road, and he was going that my way. And he turned out to be a real interesting guy. We developed a friendship. And a day before we got to Islamabad, we went through this area that had phenomenal scenery, and I can't remember the name of the place, but it's internationally known by having residents who have the oldest median age in the world or something like that. Anyway, it's all glacial country, deep canyons, and all this kind of stuff. And we were driving by scenery that was unbelievable. And I said to him, God, this is amazing. I'm never coming back. We got to take advantage of this. So we just got off this bus and rented a room. Next day, we rented a Jeep and had a driver take us all over this place and saw the place. And then we got back on and got on another bus and headed on to Islamabad. You know, you gotta do these pickup things when the opportunity strikes. And this guy was absolutely great. And we went on down to Islamabad and got a hotel room together and had our first bath in about, you know, 5 or 6 days or something like that. I thought, okay, where's Islamabad? It's the capital. I'm going to grab a flight to Singapore. I'm on my way home. Well, there wasn't any flights going to Singapore. Islamabad, as far as air travel goes, is a backwoods place. And I'm hearing about all these riots they're having down at Karachi, which is down in the southeast corner of the country, and they're the southwest corner of the country. And so I thought, this isn't too hot. I got to get out of here, but I got to go through Karachi to get back to Singapore.
Please slip your shoes up, make yourself at home.
Okay.
Sorry. So you're at the Istanbul airport and you're trying to figure out how to get home.
Yeah. So what I did, I thought, okay, they're having riots in Karachi. I'll fly down to Karachi on a flight that gets there early in the morning and everybody will be asleep. So I arranged a flight that landed in Karachi at 3 a.m. and took off for Singapore at 6 a.m. And that was a real interesting experience. We land in Karachi, and the place is pretty dead. Get off the plane and go in the airport, and there was one guy standing around with a AK-47 for every 3 people in the airport.
Wow.
That's how tight they had this place locked down. And I never saw anything at Karachi because 6 o'clock I was on a plane and we were out of there. And I was on my way home. I travel light. And when I was on the way back from Karachi all the way to the States, everything I had fit under the seat in front of me in that little backpack. And we're talking about light. Nice. And that's the way you travel.
Yeah.
The idea, if you do this stuff, the rule of thumb is take more money and less clothes.
Okay.
All you need is little money and you get anything you want.
Right.
You don't have to travel heavy. And that works here too. But anyway, that was a very interesting experience.
Nice. I wanted to go back to this area in China that had been deforested, this karst country. To go back to that for just a minute, kind of wrap this up. This deforestation began roughly the late 50s, early 60s. That's going to be 70 years ago. Today, using our Landsat images, if you look at the same area, has the forest returned or is it still?
No, it's still the same. It's a mess.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they can't get it back because there's 100 million people live down there.
Mm.
They got to use the resources. So right. they just literally mow the place over every year.
Wow.
It's a mess.
Wow.
Yeah, it just can't support much. It's a sad story.
That's amazing.
This is a lesson for everybody that nobody heeds. The islands in the Western Pacific are commonly bought by Japanese or Chinese lumbering firms, and they just go in and cut every single plant and walk and leave these places. It's going on every year, every day. We do it too. Everybody does it.
Well, it makes me think about the Amazon.
Oh, yeah. The Amazon's going as fast as you can breathe.
Yeah. The deforestation that's happening there.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
And we have lessons where this has happened in the past. If you're really interested in this stuff, take a look at the Mediterranean.
Mm.
The history of the Mediterranean is that you had goats in North Africa on the west side of the Mediterranean. So they're down there in what's that country down there? Algeria in there, okay? And sometime in BC, the goats start eating their way eastward.
Mm.
And they go all the way around. They finally go through Turkey. They get to Greece, and they get to Italy, and they get to Spain. And by the time they're done, they have eaten everything. And it is still the same way.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Yeah.
And you can see it in Venezuela, too.
Oh.
The goats are eating their way southward from the coast into the jungle. And I've driven north across Venezuela. And you start to come out of the jungle. And all of a sudden, all you see is goats everywhere.
Mm.
And then you finally pop out and you're in what is virtually a desert.
Right.
And it used to be the jungle.
Interesting.
And they just are eating your way south.
Huh.
So deforestation is a real problem.
Right.
And it's not only it's a cultural problem.
Well, it's people driven, but it's also livestock driven, right. Animal driven.
And in Venezuela, what you run into in the area where the goats are is there are all kinds of vendors that are selling goat meat along the road. And what they typically do, they've herded up a bunch of goats. They're little things. They're like a big dog. And they got a tether with 20 of them hooked there. And then they'll kill one for you and dress it out. And you can buy one of these things for about 90 cents.
Wow.
Yeah. Can you imagine that, working that hard? But there's so many vendors.
Yeah.
You know, it's just life.
Wow.
It's rough. People don't understand that until you get there and see that.
Right.
Yeah, you got to get out there and see this stuff to understand. And of course, what are they doing? They can't. They can't survive.
Exactly.
Why do we have so many Venezuelans coming to our border? They're looking for opportunity. Just.
Yeah.
Now, we have the same thing going on in Mexico. You know, everybody's heard of Copper Canyon. Copper Canyon's been eaten over by goats.
Interesting.
There's nothing there. And so you can go down to Copper Canyon, it's like going into a desert. You don't feel like hiking on the old trails that everybody used to love because there's no shade.
Huh.
And then if you get up on the plateaus around it, they're all eaten off by feral horses.
Oh, wow.
Now, everybody is concerned about building a fence along Mexico. And what they want to do is keep the poor Mexicans out. My concern is we want to keep the goats out.
Oh, interesting.
Because they're coming.
Huh. Interesting. You had a chance to go to Turkey back in the late 1990s. And the browse line, olive trees, any kind of tree, was a bare trunk up as high as a goat could reach on its back legs with its feet up on the trunk trying to eat. Everything below that was decimated.
Yeah, well, what you saw was that the first stage of this, because what you have to imagine is that eventually that tree is going to die and it's going to be gone.
Right.
The problem is if it seeds during its lifetime, the plant can't make it up to survive because the goat eats it off.
Got it.
So that's the end of it.
Got it. Okay.
So that's what happens.
Huh.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. All right. It's a phenomena that's very real, very interesting to see.
Absolutely. Peter Huntoon, this has been a fascinating oral history. Is there anything else you want to add that we haven't covered?
No, I think the thing to say is that I'm a groundwater hydrologist. But these experiences that I've just related to you are ancillary to my area of expertise. But I've sure gotten an education by traveling around, seeing this stuff. And what I've seen is a lot more interesting than me going out prospecting for groundwater, let me tell you.
Right.
And this has been very useful to me in terms of expanding my own horizons, but also to bring the stories back and to teach. And the students want to hear this kind of stuff.
I bet.
And, you know, some of them shrug their shoulders. Others are a little sensitized to it. And
right.
What I have a lot of respect for is the ones that will say, maybe I can help. I'll join a Peace Corps.
Or I'll become a water hydrologist and look around the world and see how to rebuild these areas that we have destroyed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, fascinating.
Lovely.
Okay.
Well, with that, this will conclude part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Peter Huntoon. Today is Wednesday, October 25th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Peter, thank you so very much.
Okay.